Welcome to the Canvas Within podcast. My name is Kevin Benavides, and this podcast is inspired and designed to help you overcome and grow through your challenges in life. Whether it's a mental, physical, spiritual, or even relationship challenge, my goal is to help you gain the tools and wisdom to grow through these challenges. Then, as you grow, you begin to truly awaken the unique canvas that is within you and bring your canvas within out into this physical world, which then leads you to live a more joyous, fulfilled, and purposeful life. On this episode of the podcast, my guest is Dr. Parmjeet Singh, who is an assistant clinical professor with the Department of Family Medicine at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Dr. Singh has a PhD in psychology and has a clinical training in mind-body medicine from Harvard Medical School in Boston. He also teaches mindfulness courses within the university curriculum and also holds group mindfulness courses. So I actually met Dr. Singh about a year and a half ago at one of his mindfulness courses in Mississauga, Ontario. And I thoroughly enjoyed his one-day course. And as soon as I started doing the podcast, I knew that I had to get him on to have him share his wisdom and insight on mindfulness. And on this episode, he basically talks about how mindfulness came into his life and how it's a leading factor in his daily life, and how he loves to teach it, and what it can do for us, for our mental health and also our physical health. Mindfulness is something that helped me overcome my anxiety and depression a couple of years ago, and it's something that I still practice in my life as much as I possibly can. So I know how beneficial it is. So I'm really glad that I got him on the podcast to share his wisdom with all of us. So I really hope you enjoy this episode, and thank you again for tuning in. Yes, thanks for joining us, Parmjeet.
Thank you, Kevin, for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, so am I. Definitely really interested in getting into mindfulness, because that's something that's you really teach really well, because I was in one of your courses or one of your classes about a year and a half ago, I think it was. And everything that you did during that class really resonated with me, because of mindfulness was something that helped me out in my life. So I'm interested in getting into everything, but I just want to start off and find out from you, what sparked an interest in you starting to study and practice mindfulness in your life, because you went to school first for psychology. So
I think the way my interest came to be, it's actually, we have to travel back in time into my
time.
So when I was growing up, my parents are farmers, and I started to notice that I was very much interested in human mind and what it can do. It can be your best ally, your worst, enemy, depending upon how you take it. So I think that was the beginning of my interest to understand my own mind. And to do that, that's how I actually got into psychology. I was originally planning to get into microbiology. In fact, I had prepared for 2 months to give a test, but at the last minute dropped the plan, and in fact enrolled for master's in psychology. Mm-hmm. But during this process, when I was doing undergrad, I actually visited a person who happened to be a politician, and on his coffee table in a village was a very older edition of American Psychologist. And on the front or the second page of American Psychologist was the quotation of William James, that if you can change your thoughts, you can change your life. And that was a very interesting segue at that point, because to find American Psychologist, that used to come as a kind of a very small, slightly different version than Reader Digest, was some kind of a, I would say, coincidental, because to find American Psychologist in that part of the North India at that time. So that spurred my interest further. And to continue doing that, I actually did visit a few ashrams in India during undergraduates. And one of the very special memories I have that I went to actually Shivanand Ashram. And we walked down 5K to his ashram. And I still very viscerally remember that on the hillside, there was actually small cabins where monks would actually meditate. And on the opposite side was actually snow-capped mountains. Wow. And it was a beautiful sight. Means I stayed there for one day. It was a more like an exploratory trip alongside two of my friends. But the idea that one day I will actually sit, maybe not here, but somewhere exploring into my own mind, actually kept on taking root. And that's how actually it started all. So initially, I was not practicing mindfulness. When I started it, it was a very simple meditation practice, usually breathing techniques or simply mm-hmm. concentrating the mind on any object. Mindfulness as an exclusive pursuit for me actually started when I came to Canada. So between then and now, I have been practicing. But before that, I was always interested in meditation, always interested in human mind. In fact, when I enrolled in psychology, as I said earlier, my interest was to actually understand my own mind. But I found that psychology as it is taught in academia, and especially during those times, and especially in the institute, I mm-hmm. took my master's. It was very much not really related to my own mind. It was simply a lot of theoretical structures and a lot of related things, but not so much any opportunity for me to access my own mind. So on the sideline, I kept on actually doing exploring yoga, not so much formally, but informally. A lot of this happened actually at a very informal level. I never went and did any training because one thing, nobody suggested that I should go that route. I was literally dabbling into things. And considering where I came from a small village, I don't think there was any resources for me to direct to. I wish somebody would have, because mm-hmm. that would have made my life easier. But I think I spent a large amount of my time in India actually dabbling into the things, but not really formally getting interested.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. But it was basically something that really was within you that you really wanted to explore, right? From what it sounds, because you were a different path, but all these different experiences brought forward that, you know, mindfulness is something that interests me, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, it is very interesting because the incident of me, in fact, having prepared for 2 months to take a test in microbiology and drop at last minute is actually testament to the fact that how it was actually interesting to me, because one of my friend who is a pediatrician now in India, he actually told me that, are you going to spend your rest of your life looking through the microscope? And that's one simple question actually paused me for a moment, that I'm not really interested in looking through the microscope as much as meaningful it would be. I'm not saying it cannot be meaningful, but for me, it was an idea which actually turned me off. And in fact, I took a risk in dropping my application off to microbiology and mm-hmm. step into psychology, and considering that I didn't have any formal training in psychology. So just consider this fact that I am preparing for microbiology, but then at the last minute, I decide to apply for psychology, which I have no undergraduate training, but the university I applied, that was the only one which give some sort of a preference to people who did actually sciences. So my undergraduate is in sciences. Mm-hmm. So even if you didn't have psychology, they would actually still consider you. And that was, the fact that I got in without any formal training and passed the test, entrance test, mm-hmm. that still I tend to think that my life was actually meant to be on this road.
In that route, yeah.
Otherwise, I would have not got into that.
That's interesting. That's so interesting. But so now I want to find out is like how has mindfulness changed your life since you started practicing it and also teaching it?
I think it has changed dramatically. Some of the things I thought was true of me was actually never found to be true. And that some of the things I thought that this is how I am as a person, really not came to be. One of the most important aspect, and I think two aspects which mindfulness has brought to me. Mm-hmm. One was that actually very experiential understanding how materialistic I was. Now, one can be materialistic in a consumerist sense, and one can be in a rejectionist sense. So I was the latter one. When I came to Canada, I actually pretty much took a conscious decision not to pursue anything related to monetary things. It means I would go and deliver lectures, not charge anything. And that actually brought me into a space which led us to have financial hardships. Mm-hmm. Because means here I'm in a different space and time, different country. My parents are not around, so the farming stuff is not around. I cannot go and pick up carrots from my farm. Yeah. Everything has to be bought. And then one day I realized that actually I am being materialistic, but in a very different way. I'm rejecting without understanding it. So that was one of the very epiphanous moment in my practice. Which led me to believe that one can actually continue to do the same thing, believing that he or she is doing other things. Now, one can argue that, this is such a simple thing that you can say that if you're not making money, you will get into trouble. But the fact of the matter that to understand things at a visceral level is very different than understanding things as a cognitive level. I understood at a cognitive level that if I don't go into that route, I will get into trouble. But understanding at a very visceral level actually dramatically shifted my relationship with the money. I became free, in fact. Understanding that, financial stuff is a part of life. It's just how you relate to it.
Yeah.
You can be, I was as much as slave to it by rejecting it as much as I could be free by having it. And that was one of the most epiphanous moment. I often actually tell students that it's a very simple thing which you might have understood early, but to me to understand viscerally was a very empowering moment. And the second was that I became, I stopped becoming kind of fearful as an immigrant when I came to, in fact, I have to start from scratch as an immigrant having a lived experience. It was incredibly difficult for me to bring my ideas and start actually working through it and start making some sort of a livelihood from it. Mm-hmm. When I started practicing, I started to realize that I can actually stand on my feet. I can talk from personal experience, not any more intellectual. It's very personal, very visceral. Mm-hmm. And that was the second empowering thing. So when I go to class, I can talk from the very basic personal things, how the experience came to be, what are the challenges of sitting in meditation.
Yeah.
And I'm able to relate to the people when they talk about their own personal challenges. Mm-hmm. So it was the shift from the intellectual to visceral, which in fact was the most empowering aspect of the practice itself. And that's why even in my personal life and as well as when I go to teach, I emphasize the aspect of the practice because practice has to be done. If it is not done, we actually swim around in intellectual circles, which may be as useful as they can be, but they can also mislead us into believing that we know something which we really don't know. And I went through that. I did a lot of intellectual stuff for a long period of time, believing and understanding in my mind that I actually understand it. But when I sat, literally in a formal way, I realized that significant aspect of my understanding was really flawed. It was very bookish. It was borrowed,
Yeah, and nothing really connects until you actually have the experience yourself, right? Reading it is one thing, but doing it is another.
Yeah, reading is also easier because it can inspire you, but as long as we are not investing anything into it.
Correct.
That was one of the aspects that intellectual understanding of mindfulness can be very inspiring. But when we sit on the cushion or on the chair or on the mat, we start to realize how difficult it is, how challenging it is, because we are literally falling onto our own devices. We are beginning to dismantle the concept of our own self-concept, mm-hmm. And that can be very destabilizing some people. Because one of the lot of things actually happens in the practice are very oftenly very disappointing, because the way you look at yourself is not really what you find. Mm. But that's also the beautiful part, because now you know yourself in a way which is very wholesome. It's not intellectual, it's visceral. And once it's visceral, you can stand on it. And it is actually empowering. So this discovery of imperfect understanding of our own self and coming to terms with who we are as a person is actually very empowering. To me, it was. Means now I can wear my flaws on my sleeves and actually not be apologetic about it, because that's what makes me human. Means I don't have to continue doing that. I don't have to live with the flaws if those flaws can be corrected, but understanding and not running away from them and building up a different self-image is what's phenomenal, understanding that out of the practice only.
Yeah.
And it continues,
It always continues, always through your life, right? As long as you continue to use it in your life, right? And now I wanted to, mindfulness for me changed my life. When I was dealing with anxiety, mainly anxiety, and then also depression a couple of years ago, mindfulness is what got me out of it. Practicing mindfulness, not just mindfulness and meditation, but in life in general. So I just wanted to start to talk about that, because I really want to get to people to understand the benefits of it, of mindfulness in their lives. So what would you say are the benefits of mindfulness for people who are dealing with anxiety and depression?
The research is actually accumulating about the beneficial aspect of training your mind to be present. Because we know when people get depressed, especially when they get into the clinical side of depression, it's the relapse, which is very interesting in itself. Because one thought, one can be having a good stretch in their life, and then something happens. And because that one event, once they latch on to that, can actually spiral them down and pull them down into another depressive episode. In fact, if I'm not incorrect, every depressive relapse actually makes the next one possible increases by 18 or 16%. Mm-hmm. So that's actually, it's a huge, huge contribution to relapse. So in the context of the depression and anxiety, the research is accumulating that it's actually useful. However, certain things need to be said in the context that if it works in as a kind of adjunctive therapy, it actually wonderfully works. So that somebody actually taking on self-medicating. So self-medicating as a way to actually come out of the anxiety, severe anxiety disorder. So this conversation is very contextual in the context of severe things. Mm-hmm. Mild to moderate, I think it's pretty much, it can work pretty well. But once you get into the severe aspect, it has to be modulated with the collaboration with your physician. Because then you are on the safe hand. You're doing something, you're using... The medical aspect of the therapy to keep you in the line, and then you're using your mind to actually come out of it. So if the skill is developed to the extent, then the two aspects can balance itself, and it can be very useful for people who are actually suffering to it. So that's the one thing I would suggest, because there is a tendency for people to self meditate and use it as a strategy in lieu of medical treatment. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, if we say that, okay, you don't have to do that, we actually do a disservice. We bring people to harm. But if we say that if you use it as a collaborative, venture between your physician and yourself, and keep on working with your mind, and hopefully develop a skill which allows you to work through the stuff you're going through, then the both things actually come to a good place.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. For me, I wasn't under any medication. I never really took any medication. I guess maybe I would have helped in a way, but I never wanted to. But for me, with the mindfulness, was training my mind to become present, because anxiety is all about the future and depression is about the past. So if you can get your mind to be focused in the present moment, then it sort of, it doesn't stop the anxiety altogether, but you find a way how to focus when you are in an attack or when you are depressive. It's like a tool in your belt that you can pull out and use. And for me, it was sort of like practicing it in my daily life, not just sitting all the time and meditating. That helped, that trained my mind, but it was when certain reactions would come up in my body, anger or sadness, I would be able to watch it and not engage in it. And that's the mindfulness that really helped me. But in regards to that, I've learned over the years, looking into more mindfulness practices, that the way that it's taught in the Eastern part of the world compared to here in North America or the Western world, it's similar, very similar, but the difference that I see is that in Western mindfulness, we're taught to, an emotion comes up to learn to watch it, but it's almost like you're taught to suppress it, right? And you suppress and you suppress and you suppress. So you're getting through your day and not having, you know, an anxiety attack or with the mindfulness, but you're really not working through it, which I think that's what Eastern mindfulness does, or the original mindfulness is yes, you stop it, but you actually have to inquire and look into what is happening with yourself. So I was wondering which way is the way that you teach, and would you recommend for people to look into or to study and practice themselves?
So there are two things here. One is that the Eastern version of the mindfulness and the Western version, there's actually a few distinctive aspects which can be figured out as we work through this. One of the things is that the mindfulness, whether it's actually Eastern or it's taught in the Western domain, is oftenly should not be about suppressing. It's about actually recognizing and not reacting to it. So not reacting to it, to me, is not as suppressing. So you're not actually trying to put a lid on it. You're simply allowing things to come up, but you're taking a kind of internal stand not to react to it. For example, anger can come up, and the anger can actually fill your whole body. But for that moment, you take a kind of internal vow that for this moment, I'm not going to throw a punch. So what's happening in this moment? You're not suppressing the expression of the anger in the body, but you're literally allowing the consciousness to absorb it. You know? So to me, that's not suppression. That means that you're actually allowing the anger to come up, but you are not externalizing it by throwing a punch. It means you're not reacting to it. And by doing so, we allow the emotions to bubble up and dissipate itself. And I think it doesn't matter whether it's in the Western context or in the Eastern context. The things, the way I understand, that's where not the Eastern or Western actually differs. Eastern or Western differs on other aspects. For example, in the Western aspect, it's the focus is a lot more on the self. Or in the present moment. And that's true in the Eastern too, but there's actually additional stuff in the context of the Eastern, the mindfulness, that, for example, their focus would also be about the skillfulness, the purposefulness. Their focus will all be on the ethical stuff, that there's no ethical neutrality in the context of making decision in the original mindfulness. Sometimes it seems like in the Western mindfulness arena, we tend to say that you can be ethically neutral by observing, but actually in the original context, there's some sort of ethical anchor point where you have to make a very informed decision so that you can be on the right side of the spectrum than on the left side. Then there's also a focus on what we call the right kind of mindfulness, you know, which allows for us to develop wisdom. You know, one can be mindful, but if they are always mindful of all the wrong stuff, then that is not going to develop, you know, that kind of wisdom. So there's emphasis on the right kind of mindfulness, right speech, right mindfulness, right action. So sometimes I feel that in the way things are actually working in the context of the mindfulness, that it is becoming progressively decontextualized. So people are actually progressively making it, oversimplifying it, so that it can be understood by the masses. Mm-hmm. And I understand the intent, but what it does, it actually progressively dilutes the impact of it, you know. So another, coming back to what other distinctive parts is, for example, Eastern mindfulness would emphasize not only the focus to the self, but focus to the others also, you know, not only to the present, but also to the past and the future. Mm-hmm. And in coming to the context of what you asked, that, you know, that exploring the nature of the experience itself can be in itself a part of the process, which is actually very much rooted into the mindfulness practice. Because when we sit and a thought comes around, you know, if our mind is stable enough, we can actually follow the thought and explore it a little bit, where it comes from, where it is leading to it. So that part of the process, I think it's still taught in some people who, especially people who have a very solid practice. Mm-hmm. They do emphasize the aspect that, okay, you can explore where the thought is coming from and where it leads to you without getting tangled up in it, and come back to the present moment and start the process once again.
Yeah.
But the distinctive parts are actually a lot more, to me, is the ethical aspect, which is the moral aspect of the practice and how it has been becoming increasingly decontextualized, because it is being, tailor-made to fit into the scientific method and model, and that has its own challenges. But I think the researchers are now beginning to ask these questions, that is this divergence is going to have some consequences down the lane, because mm-hmm. I tend to think that it would have. In my experience working with the people, there's a sense, for example, I give you an example. Sometime I go to do the work and people will say that I'm here in this space because I want to learn so that I can teach others. And that's a fair aspiration. There's nothing really wrong about that. But the one problematic aspect, almost unspoken aspect of this, is that when we are focused on teaching the others without actually learning it first, then we actually miss the point that large part of the mindfulness practice and the teaching is very much rooted into the practice. When you sit on the cushion and you work through the own challenges, you come to realize that there's some similarity, a thread that runs through everybody, and then you can actually teach them there. The challenges I worked through, and I said the visceral aspect is the one which allowed me to see the challenges people faced. Because I can tell you, before I started actually doing this, when people would come, especially when I was teaching those courses at Mac, people will ask, and my answers will be very bookish, you know, because they were bookish because it didn't come from my heart.
Yeah.
And because they were bookish, those people could not relate it. And one of the things that actually came to me is that practice allows you to understand the nuances of learning.
Yeah.
And the nuances of learnings are very important for nuances of teaching, because I cannot, and I suspect everybody cannot actually teach unless they actually learn it properly. Be a good student. Being a good student is actually prereq for being a good teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are a few things actually in the context of the Eastern and Western, but large part of, to me, is actually the ethical aspect, which mm-hmm. is beginning to get blurred, and I think it should be brought in.
Yeah, for sure. But like you were saying right now, it goes back to what we originally were talking about experience, right? When you actually experience it in your life, it's completely different than reading it in a book. And I agree, right? Because we can read up on all these things and just say what's in the book and teach, or you can say, hey, listen, you know, for myself, you know, I was dealing with anxiety. When I meditated, this is what I noticed. And this, and then people will say, hey, that's the exact same thing that I feel, because that's the connection, right? You want to have that connection on the human level of, this is what we feel as humans when we're dealing with what X, Y, or Z, whatever we're dealing with, right? So
yeah, because intellectual landscape can be very antiseptic. It can mm-hmm. be very clinical, you know?
Yeah.
But experiential landscape is oftenly messy. But also within that messiness, this is where we meet.
Mm-hmm.
So when you experience your messiness and when I experience my messiness, when we sit, this is where the things collide, where the things come back. And we realize that beyond our shallow differences, there's something which actually connects us as human beings. And mindfulness is literally a way of connecting with each other beyond the shallow differences, which are, I'm not saying they are not useful. They are very useful, mm-hmm. but they are actually still shallow.
Yes.
They are external differences.
I agree. So just before we wrap up the interview, I wanted to ask about your canvas within. I have two questions for you. The first one is, what does the canvas within Parmjeet look like?
It's often very open, spacious. It's unpainted. It's literally kind of an open space. And okay. I am not sure. It's a kind of a, because I grew up in a farm, I still have a fascination for open spaces. And maybe I often sometimes wonder that maybe I gravitated to this practice because I lived in a farm, and when I woke up in the morning, I stepped into a huge open space. You know, and sometimes it will be literally open. There's nothing, no crops there. Between the crops, there will be times when there's literally land from one end of the stretch to the other end of the stretch. So I would say the canvas in me is actually very open, and partly I think it's how I grew up, and partly because of my practice, because I keep on keeping it cleaning up.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing that. And then the other question I wanted to ask you is, I believe that every day we get to paint our own canvases with different colors, and depends on the colors that we use will paint the picture of our day, whether it's a good or bad day or whatever way you want to label it. So I wanted to find out is what colors does the canvas within you have? Like what are your colors on your canvas?
That's a very interesting question. Means my favorite colors are actually orange and blue and even to some extent, I think the blue and orange would be the best one. Mm-hmm. You know? But the canvas, the color actually continues to change. I wake up and the day has different colors because things have happened. Yeah. And you go to the sleep and the canvas has changed because some things happened. And some of those colors are very bright. Some of those colors are very gray and very, very disheartening. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter that every day the canvas has different colors is actually the most important part, because it's the impermanence that, you know, the canvas we start during the day at the beginning of the day is not the canvas we get at the end of the day and the next day. And so I usually don't get attached to the colors. I usually think that this is the color I got to deal with today. Let's work with it. And when the next color shows up, we work with that. You know, that's the way I look at it.
That's great. I love the answer. I think that's a great way of looking at it. And it's true, right? Our day, the day changes. So the colors, depending on our moods, change too, right? Yeah. And the fact that every day it's different. Every day it's a clean slate every time we open our eyes, right? So.
Yeah, it's basically that's what impermanence is. What the mindfulness is, that recognizing and understanding and rolling with the changing transitory aspect of life and the colors and the lack of colors. And it's not only colors. I think the lack of colors also part of the canvas.
Yeah.
And that's what life is.
Perfect. Great way to end it off. Thank you so much. So I want to thank you again for taking your time out of your day, being on the podcast. Thank you.
Thank you so much.